Nearly 24 students will graduate from MIT next month with a degree in an emerging field, a new kind of engineering, biological engineering. It's attracting a lot of interest from agriculture, medicine, and NPR science correspondent Robert Krowich. He's been thinking a lot about the biotech revolution from his desk at a place called Radiolab. That sound means we're there. And Robert, remind us what it is.
Radiolab is a place where we explore big ideas that make us rethink ourselves and the whole world around us. It's a place where you'll find my partner in crime, Radiolab's creator, Jed Abumrad.
Hey, Robert. Hey, Renee.
Hey.
So I've been looking at the promises of this new field, bioengineering, and nobody waxes more eloquent or dreams more broadly about this than Freeman Dyson.
Who is, by the way, a physicist at Princeton and famous for his work in quantum mechanics.
So let me just play you what he said at a graduation speech he gave recently at the University of Michigan.
There will be do-it-yourself kits for gardeners who will use genetic engineering to breed new varieties of roses and orchids. Kits for lovers of pigeons and parrots and lizards and snakes to breed new varieties of pets. Genetic engineering, once it gets into the hands of housewives and children, will give us an explosion of diversity of new living creatures.
That's quite a vision. So, Robert, let me ask, how far off do you think this sci-fi future
really
is?
Far, far. It's not far off. It is here. It is now. There are kids today who are already up to their chins in bioengineering.
Really?
How old were you when you did this?
I guess I was 20. I'm 21 right now.
Okay, who are you? What's your name and what do you do?
I'm Stephen Payne. I'm a senior in biological engineering at MIT.
Now, here's the thing about Stephen. He, like most kids who are in the sciences in college, had to spend hours and hours and hours in the lab waiting for E. coli to slowly grow in a Petri dish.
E. coli, like the stuff that gives you food poisoning?
Well, yeah, it's the stuff. It's common bacteria, and it lives naturally in your gut, and it's, by the way, a big laboratory favorite. And the problem is, says Reshma Sethi, who's a grad student at MIT, is E. coli in the raw?
Actually smell really bad.
What does it smell like?
It actually kind of smells, I guess, maybe like poo. I don't know. What do you think it smells like?
Feces.
Anyway, Stephen and his friends got it into their heads that they could make
E. coli that smell,
you know, nicer.
Yep, nicer smell.
Like cinnamon or cherry.
Or like minty fresh.
We ended up deciding on wintergreen.
Wintergreen?
Like, you got something against wintergreen?
I mean, no.
In the real world, who has wintergreen?
It's the petunia plant.
Petunias have wintergreen? I have no idea.
Yeah. A lot of folks study why plants make nice smells. So why do roses smell nice? Why do petunias smell nice? So what we did was we requested from one of these folks, Natalia Dudareva from Purdue University. We asked her to send us a sample of one of the genes she had studied that produces this wintergreen smell.
She mailed it.
Through the mail.
They opened it up.
We took it.
Took it out.
What were you taking out? A little bit of gunk?
It's actually living cells, living dried cells.
Yeah. We pulled out the DNA, put it into a new cell.
And once the new DNA had done its thing, Stephen called everybody into the lab.
And we all came over and we're like, whoa, these, you know, this E. coli culture actually does smell like mint.
And we were like, yay.
That's crazy.
Yay.
So instead of smelling poo all day, they get to smell wintergreen.
Well, actually, there was more than that, because after their wintergreen success, Stephen and Reshma decided, you know, why should we stay in the lab all day, even though it smells nicer now? Because we have to sit there and watch these E. coli grow and grow and grow till they're ready to be experimented on. We could be outside playing Frisbee. So they decided to put a little trigger inside the E. coli. So when it's done growing, it switches from wintergreen to banana.
Banana?
Banana.
Yeah, the banana.
So banana.
You know, it smells like a banana milkshake. I mean, it smells more like a banana than a banana does.
So wintergreen means it's still growing, and banana means we're done.
Yep.
Guys, that's really kind of awe-inspiring.
Absolutely. Like in a grabbing evolution by the scruff of the neck,
well,
kind of way.
But one does wonder, since we are here talking about constructing life, whether we really ought to be doing this thing with quite such abandon. Were you at all intrigued by the idea that, as far as I know, and I'm maybe as far as you know, maybe as far as anybody know, in the history of the E. coli creature, there has never been an E. coli that smelled like wintergreen?
Yep.
You made it yourself.
Well, with the help of my team members, yes.
Did you feel a little spooked by the fact that you just created a life form new to creation?
I mean, at least we're doing something that's, you know, smells pleasant.
But you didn't feel like Dr. Frankenstein or God or...
Not at all.
So what does it feel like to make something that's never existed before?
Just feels like basic engineering.
Yeah, we're engineers. I would say we're engineers. We're building stuff. Building stuff. Building stuff.
Building stuff. Stuff, stuff, and not just stuff. Stuff, stuff, but living stuff.
The road ahead is bright and clear.
Wow. I don't know. That's a long way from the Bunsen burners in my chemistry
Very
class.
Very long way. And Steve and Reshma are just two of now what is hundreds of people who are beginning to fiddle with life and who are marching off into a future which we should at least be watching closely.
Robert Jad, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks.
That's Jad Abumrad and Robert Krowich from Radiolab, a production of WNYC.
Swapping genes.
It's mankind's only fighting chance. Designer genes, not denim pants. We'll stop disease and greenhouse gases. Sequencing nucleic acids. Crack the code, we've seen the light.
We're building stuff.
We're building life.
We're building life.
The road ahead is bright and clear. Because we're
You can explore Radiolab and all sorts of new organisms at npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Florida legislature has been considering evolution. State lawmakers have passed bills that would allow or require teachers to present alternate theories of how life evolved. Proponents say at issue is academic freedom. Critics say the bills would introduce religion into public schools. NPR's Greg Allen reports from Miami.
It's titled the Evolution Academic Freedom Act, and here's one of its sponsors, Republican State Representative Alan Hayes.
What are you afraid of? Are you afraid that our students are going to learn how to critically analyze a theory?
The bill passed by a wide margin in Florida's House on Monday. It requires teachers to provide their students with, quote, a thorough presentation and scientific critical analysis of the theory of evolution. What that analysis would be isn't clear, but proponents say it would have to be scientific, not religious. Hayes says it was needed to protect teachers who feel intimidated by school district policies that prevent them from teaching alternate views to the theory of evolution. Opponents, mostly Democrats like Representative Franklin Sands, said all the talk about academic freedom is a smokescreen.
Let's be real clear on what it is that we're actually voting about. We're voting about the separation of church and state. We're voting about teaching religion in schools. You can couch it any way you want, but what that is exactly what we're talking about.
To help clarify that issue, last week when a similar bill was debated and passed in Florida's Senate, opponents introduced an amendment that would allow teachers to present the full range of scientific viewpoints on sex education. That amendment was quickly voted down. Opponents say the measure sends a negative message to research institutions and biotech companies, a business sector the state has spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to promote in Florida. Representative Hayes said he believed the man behind the theory of evolution, Charles Darwin, would not object to allowing teachers and their students critically analyze his ideas.
A true scientist is searching for the truth, and that's what we should be encouraging our students and our teachers in the public schools of this state to search for every day, is search for the truth.
One of those pleased by yesterday's vote was John West of the Discovery Institute. That's a group based in Seattle that promotes intelligent design and has long worked to raise questions about evolution. West says Discovery has written model legislation on this issue of academic freedom for states to consider.
And that model legislation certainly has influenced debates in various states, and in the Senate version of the Florida bill, parts of it were adapted from this model language.
Similar bills are also being considered in Louisiana and Missouri. In Florida, the precipitating factor was the adoption earlier this year of science standards for public schools that for the first time mentioned evolution. And as that idea was being discussed in Tallahassee, a new film came to town.
I made a movie.
Join Ben Stein in this year's most controversial documentary film.
If they value their careers, they should keep quiet about their intelligent design views.
The sponsor of the bill in the House, Alan Hayes, was one of the legislators who attended a private screening of Expelled, a movie by conservative economist and social critic Ben Stein. Hayes says if people wonder if there's a scientific controversy about the teaching of evolution, they should see the film. Although both Florida's Senate and House have now approved bills encouraging students and teachers to question evolution, it's uncertain that anything will become law this session. There are some big differences between the two bills, and there may not be enough time to reconcile them before Florida's legislature adjourns on Friday. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Some of the troops who removed Saddam's government face legal problems of their own. Some American veterans come home with physical or mental wounds. Some get in trouble with the law. And now a judge in Buffalo, New York, has created a special court for them. Here's NPR's Libby Lewis.
Gary Pettengill wanted the military to be his career. But the Army made him take a medical discharge in 2006 after he blew out his back in Iraq. End of career. He was married with a third kid on the way. He was 23 years old. He started smoking marijuana to deal with the nightmares from his PTSD and the empty days, and he started selling it to make up the gap between the part-time work his back could handle, the food stamps, and everything else.
Diapers, if you run out of formula, it's like $21 a can, clothing.
In February, he got busted in a drug sweep with 2 pounds of marijuana. Just like that, Pettengill went from combat veteran to drug villain. He was on the brink of doing serious time and losing his kids to child welfare because of the drugs. His family got kicked out of their apartment. Then he got lucky and got referred to Judge Robert Russell's Veterans Court. Today, he's one of about 20 veterans in the court that convenes on Tuesday afternoons. They served in Vietnam, the Middle East, the Persian Gulf, and Afghanistan. They're sitting quietly in the courtroom, waiting to be called. A line of military volunteers, most of them veterans, a couple of active duty officers, lines one wall.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir.
Hi, Gary.
Hello.
Pettengill has a buzz cut and a clean plaid shirt so big it looks like he might disappear in it any moment. He stands before Judge Russell.
Nice to see you, and why not give me an update?
My family and I moved into a new home.
That's good.
Been there for about a week now.
How do you like it?
It's pretty nice, different neighborhood, pretty quiet, a lot bigger, though, than before, more room for the kids to play inside.
It sounds like small talk, but it's not. It's the nitty-gritty. The judge is listening for signs of stability that can keep Pettengill out of jail. Since his arrest, the Veterans Court, working with the VA, has helped Pettengill get part-time work, cash and housing assistance for an apartment, and drug rehab. He has one of the volunteer veteran mentors. Now Judge Russell's talking to him like they're catching up over coffee.
And how is the family doing?
They're doing good. Still hard balancing around a lot of my appointments, and she's trying to get a job also.
Russell and his staff started this docket in January when they realized more and more veterans were showing up in court. They counted 300 vets coming into the local courts last year. A lot of them were showing up in drug and mental health court. Those so-called problem-solving courts are aimed more at getting treatment and help for the people in them than imprisonment. Russell and his staff were seeing the figures on the large numbers of Iraq veterans coming home with PTSD, like Gary Pettengill, and brain injuries.
The reality is that we knew that we had to develop something now, because soon there'll be 400,000 coming home.
Hank Perowski heads Judge Russell's staff. He says a lot of the vets they've seen got into trouble because they were dealing with the aftermath of combat.
You know, it starts out simply from a prescription abuse to illicit substances to some type of crime activity to support that habit to being arrested, going to jail.
Perowski says Buffalo is trying to do right by veterans and to prevent bigger problems like suicide and violence. Gary Pettengill says he was headed for suicide before he wound up in Judge Russell's court. He was down and out in one of the poorest cities in America.
I was having nightmares and I couldn't sleep, and I have problems like if I can't sleep a couple days on end, I get, it's like I want to do anything to rest, anything.
Pettengill says now he realizes he turned to drugs to fill a void that opened up when he left the Army. He's hoping Judge Russell's court will help him stay on track.
You know, I have three beautiful children, and they need their father, and I don't want, you know, a suicide hanging over their heads for the rest of their lives either.
Hank Porowski says he and Judge Russell have thought a lot about the stories of Iraq veterans who came home and then lost it and killed themselves or other people.
If we would have reached that person sooner, would they have gotten to this point and to that charge? Would that have happened? You know, and that's a good question. You know, had that person been diagnosed properly, can we or may we have stopped that? There's a chance that we could have.
Do they know that for sure? Nope. But they're trying anyway. And there are signs other places will try too. Libby Lewis, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. There are a lot of homes for sale in Lee County, Florida. Real estate prices exploded when the market was humming a few years ago. That was before lots and lots of foreclosures sent prices tumbling and turned Lee County into a giant bargain basement for house hunters. Analysts say it will take 3 to 5 years to work through the unsold inventory. For the second of two reports, NPR's Jim Zaroli rode around with a real estate agent who's trying to turn the glut of bank-owned properties to his advantage.
Every day in Lee County, some 40 new foreclosed homes come onto the market.
It was busted open.
And right now, real estate agent Mark Joseph and his staff of three are climbing out of their bright green bus to inspect one.
Three-bedroom, two-bath, built in the year 2000, has 2,132 square feet of living. It's 47 cents on the dollar.
The house exemplifies the dramatic downturn in the real estate market here. It sold for $685,000 less than 2 years ago. The bank took it over and is now trying to unload it for $325,000. That's a drop of more than 50%. Joseph and his staff split up to inspect the property. He says before people surrender their homes to the bank, they often strip them bare, taking appliances, light fixtures, even closet doors.
They're in a financial crisis. So some of those things that they can get cash for are pool pumps, pool heaters, and air conditioners. And even though they're selling them off very cheap, it's still moving money and gas money for somebody that may be in a financial crisis.
This house is in pretty good shape.
Monty, how did the rooms look?
Bathroom right there around the tub. Needs drywall where the faucets are. It's okay. All caved in.
Okay.
But overall, it's not too bad. Looks pretty good.
Okay. Very good. Jen, how about our kitchen? Tell me about our kitchen.
Joseph decides to show the home on his next foreclosure tour. A few months ago, Joseph noticed something. There was an incredible number of foreclosures happening in the area, and everywhere he went, people asked about them. They wanted in on the great deals.
Real estate is feast or famine. Right now, there's a lot of famine going on, and I'm a survivor. What a better business model than to buy a bus and take him out and show him foreclosures.
Joseph painted the bus bright green and printed Foreclosure Tours Are Us on the side. It was so gaudy, his homeowners association wouldn't let him park it in his driveway overnight. But the tours are drawing customers, and the money he earns from commissions is keeping his business going through the downturn.
So as far as the waterfront wonderland of Florida, it's Cape Coral.
The next morning, about a dozen people show up for a tour. Joseph stands in front of the bus with a microphone, tossing quips like a stand-up comic. He says he always figured that when he turned 40, he'd buy a Porsche. Instead, he marked his midlife crisis with a green bus. A few people laugh politely. The crowd here is a serious one, intent on finding the good deals. Joseph has connections with the banks, so he often hears about foreclosures before other agents. Some of the homes we see are in pristine shape, but there are also ranches with weedy driveways and algae-filled pools. The group includes a Canadian couple taking advantage of the weak U.S. dollar and two locals who want to buy a condo for their daughter. There's also Leo Felber, a retired courier who says he's tired of shoveling snow in Rhode Island. He says prices here have grown more reasonable.
I was down here when they were at their peak, and they've really dropped drastically.
Did you think of buying before?
Not when the prices were high, no. I mean, they were just too high. I mean, I can afford what's down here now.
That is the silver lining in the real estate crisis. Mark Joseph says a lot of people who couldn't afford to buy in Lee County 2 years ago, including teachers and cops and service workers, can suddenly do so again. Joseph knows that some people see him as an opportunist, profiting from other people's misfortunes, but he insists he's helping the area recover.
I'm helping the economy out by taking the product off the market that's driving our economy down, and I'm taking the product that is driving the economy down, and I'm putting it in hands of people that deserve it, the affordable buyers that are out there that couldn't buy 2.5 years ago.
And buyers, he says, are eager to take advantage of the prices. 2 days after the tour, two of the people who rode on the bus called Joseph to say they won a bid on properties they saw. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
And you can hear the first of Jim's stories on the many home foreclosures in Lee County, Florida, at NPR.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a psychologist and family therapist, Dr. Dan Gottlieb has helped many people through some of the most difficult passages of their lives. He's also endured a great deal of physical and emotional pain of his own. Nearly 29 years ago, he was in a car accident that left him with quadriplegia, paralyzed from the chest down. On his first visit to Fresh Air, Dr. Gottlieb, or Dr. Dan as he's often called, described how he became devoted to his work after the accident. He subsequently made a mark in his field not only through his private practice, but through his popular radio show on WHYY Radio in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, his newspaper column in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and his books. His new book is called Learning from the Heart, Lessons on Living, Loving, and Listening. Dan, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Now, the last time you were here, you mentioned that you were part of the first generation with quadriplegia who've lived into their late 50s, thanks to advancements in medical science. So let me just start by asking you, how's your health now?
Not good. There have been some changes over the last two, three years, that have kind of told me that I've turned a page in my life. Quadriplegics, paraplegics are prone to a lot of urinary tract infections. I've always had a lot of urinary tract infections. And 2 years ago, I got one that just wasn't going away for the first time. All the antibiotics wasn't knocking it out. And the urologist said it's not going to go away. So we have to do all sorts of other interventions. I've been fine with that for a couple of years, but I know my days are numbered when the maintenance dose of the antibiotic isn't going to work. And then my heart rate dropped precipitously last summer, and I had to have a pacemaker put in. It was emergency surgery. Ordinarily, having a pacemaker in is no big deal. And within hours after the pacemaker was in, I was having wild, dangerous fluctuations in my blood pressure from 300 over 200 all the way down to, it was as low as 55 over 35 once. And more recently, my muscles have been fatiguing, and we might hear it through the course of the interview, even my intercostal muscles.
Which are those?
Fatigued. It's the ones that help me get my voice out, that force words out of my mouth. And I feel a kind of air hunger sometimes because feel air hunger. And that comes and goes. And 80-90% of the time, I feel fine.
You were saying to me right before we started the interview that you feel like your body's going in one direction and your career is going in the other direction. Can you talk about that a little bit more? You feel like your body is failing you in some fundamental way, but at the same time, your career just keeps, you know, taking off. Your previous book, Letters to Sam, did really well. It's published in 14 languages. You've got a new book that's just come out. You're doing a TV special. I mean, can you talk about that paradox?
It's almost as though I'm watching a movie here, and it's really an interesting movie. You used language, though, that I disagree with.
Go ahead.
You said my body is failing me. And my language is my body is getting tired. I've got a different relationship with my body over the last 5-10 years. My body has served me nobly. It has worked very hard, way above and beyond.
Oh, see, I really like what you're saying, because what you're saying is that you're not having an antagonistic relationship with your body. It's like, you know, your body's had a hard time and you're grateful to it for having hung in there and done its best.
Deeply grateful.
It's so easy to get angry with your body anytime something goes wrong. So I appreciate the distinction that you just made.
Yeah, deeply, deeply grateful. And I care for my body like it is a fragile lover that I adore.
Did it take you a while to reach that point of not getting angry with it?
Oh, yeah. After my accident, before my accident, I was a young man, so I was ashamed of it. And after my accident, I hated it. I felt betrayed by my body. And after that, you know, I said that I have to treat my body kindly, but it acts like a terrorist to me. And now I don't feel that way. When something happens, it's the voice of my body's exhaustion. That's how I feel. And I feel great compassion and gratitude for my body.
So getting back to my poorly worded question, mm-hmm. How does it feel to have your body feel increasingly tired while your career is getting bigger?
It depends on what time of day you ask me. If you ask me in the middle of the night when I can't sleep, I'll say terrifying is how it feels. But during the day, it's really interesting. I don't know where it's going to go or what's going to happen. I'm going to ride it as long as I can ride it. I am clear about why I work. I am clear about what my life means to me. And I am clear I am living a meaningful life.
You've had several near-death experiences because of the quadriplegia and related problems of that. Does this feel fundamentally different? I mean, because you've always pulled through.
Yeah, it does feel different. I've had a couple of doctors say that they thought my body was wearing out. My body feels tired. It doesn't feel emergent, what's happening to me. I could live another decade. I certainly hope I do. It doesn't feel emergent, but it does feel like my life is getting smaller. Now, watch, we could turn around a week from now and, you know, I could be fine. But the way I feel now, my body is getting tired.
Dan, we talked about this the last time you were on the show, but for people who didn't hear that, just tell us briefly about your accident, like what happened.
I was driving westbound on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, December 20th, 1979, and an 18-wheel truck was driving eastbound, and a wheel broke off the truck, not just a tire, the whole wheel, metal frame and all, and bounced across the turnpike and crushed my car. The last thing I remember seeing was a big black thing in the sky coming down, and seconds later, of course, my life was forever changed. I believe, though, that most of us have been hit by a black thing, that in a millisecond, your life is forever changed. You're no sidewalk under your feet, and you're in free fall. You know, it's a doctor saying, I think it's malignant, or a spouse saying, I don't think I can do this anymore, or a sudden death of someone you love. It's what's happened to me is not unusual at all. Looks different, but at the deepest levels, it's not unusual.
I'm trying to remember whether it's in your book or in one of your recent newspaper columns that you wrote about how in dealing with your own anxiety, and like most of us, you have your share, you, among other things, do meditation.
Yes.
And you describe once a 3-day like meditation retreat. You come home and, you know, that night, 2 a.m, you wake up with this big anxiety attack. Your heart is beating. And you're basically talking to your anxiety, saying, it's been 5 hours since the meditation retreat, and already you're not leaving me alone.
And I devoted 3 full days, full time, to caring for my mind. It gave me 5 hours, not to mention $400 for this damn retreat. And there's the mind agitated. But But I want to put that in context for you.
Yeah.
About 6 months ago, a friend of mine was concerned about her 8-year-old son. He watched films of 9/11, and now he was scared all of a sudden of airplanes flying in his window. And they didn't know whether to see, he needs to see a therapist, if something should be done, if she can be, do. And I usually don't see kids that age, but I do it informally, over coffee, the three of us talk. And I told him, I heard this story, and I told him, you know, this is an age where we learn about death, where we start thinking about death, and it's pretty scary. I said, some people get over it, and some people don't. I said, I didn't. I said, I was scared to death when I was your age, and my fear was the boogeyman. Boogeyman was under my bed, and I thought if I laid still and didn't even move my eyeballs, the boogeyman wouldn't get me. I said, but I was scared to death every night I went into bed. So this kid looks at me and he says, so where's the boogeyman now? The boogeyman ever go away? And I've got this deepest, but you can't lie to a kid that age because they'll catch you, you know. So I said, I'll tell you the truth. I said, the boogeyman's still under my bed. I said, but after all these years, boogeyman's old and he can't hurt me anymore. You know, he's been there all, he just doesn't have the strength to hurt me. So he's there. I don't get scared of him. He's like an old buddy after all these years. And that's my relationship to my anxiety. You know, it's there. I don't particularly enjoy it, but I don't know what I'd do without it. Wouldn't be me.
How do you distance yourself from it? Like when you wake up with your heart beating in the middle of a big, you know, anxiety attack, how do you not get totally caught up in the panic?
It's my mind. I just watch my mind doing what it does. And because I'm able to watch my mind now, I'm able to use the data from my past.
What do you mean?
Well, the data is every time I've had a panic, it hasn't lasted for the rest of my life. It hasn't been real. It always passes. Another emotion is always there waiting to come right around the corner. So when I'm in the middle of this panic, I'm not suggesting I don't suffer. I suffer the same way, you know, the rest of my neurotic cohorts suffer. But there's a quality of knowingness that I have. There's an observer inside of me that observes with compassion. I feel the same way about my mind that I feel about my body. I feel the same way about me that I feel about my body.
So you're not really angry with your mind for having the anxiety that's leading to the panic?
No, it's my neurotic mind. I mean, it's me. You know, it's me. Meditation is really about paying attention. Enlightenment is simply about shining a light on what is. And the more you pay attention to exactly what you're feeling, rather than try to fix it, the less likely it is to stay for a long time because you're going to be aware of another feeling coming around the corner.
Do you or have you ever taken like anti-anxiety pills or antidepressants? I mean, you're a therapist, so you know your way around these drugs. I'm sure you've had many patients who've been on them and you've had suggestions about whether they should remain on them or not. When it comes to yourself, do you think that you should get an assist from an anti-anxiety pill when you know that it threatens to get the better of you for a while?
Sure. I've got a history, Terry. I think I might have mentioned it, of clinical depression. And clinical depression is a serious illness of one's brain, and it needs treatment. And I take a low dose of an antidepressant every night, partly to help with insomnia and partly to keep a baseline of antidepressants on board. I think antidepressants are abused. It's of great concern to me. And when they're used appropriately, they're a godsend. You know, we talked about compassion for my body, for my mind. To take these medications is really an act of compassion for your brain. Your brain is suffering when you're depressed. It's in an unhealthy environment. It's being assaulted. And it's an act of compassion for one's brain to get help.
In your new book, Learning from the Heart, or maybe it was in your newspaper column, you tell a story about after your father died and you went to the funeral parlor to give them personal effects to put in the casket with him and to examine, you know, how they'd prepared the body. You noticed that on his head they had put on the prayer cap, the kippah or yarmulke. And you had to think, well, my father wasn't really a believer, so should I ask him to take it off or should I leave it on? Tell us what went through your mind and what you did.
My father was more than a non-believer. He was a passionate atheist, my dad. So I thought, well, should I take it off to respect him? And then I thought, well, what if, you know, who knows and what's it mean? And, you know, maybe there is somebody up there and maybe there's somebody's judgmental. And I had him take it off. I finally decided. I called the funeral director. And all this ruminating took, you know, 5 seconds. So my relationship with my dad was I always crapped around with him. I mean, my sense of humor comes from him. He didn't have a good sense of humor, but he laughed so easily, and I loved to crap around. So I have the funeral director come, and he takes the yarmulke off and takes it in the back. And there my dad and I are alone there, and I look in the casket, and I say, you owe me one for that. First time he didn't laugh. I was half expecting him to.
So you wanted to respect his position as an atheist. Are you a person of a faith? Are you an atheist?
I am a person of faith, and I go to synagogue almost every Friday night, and I don't believe in the God they pray to.
Okay, you can explain that.
No, I can't. I can try. I believe there is something divine in this life, in me, in you. Our most solemn prayer, the Shema, says God is one. And I take that literally. So what does that mean? Well, maybe what it means is when we are one as a people, or even at this moment when we are one, maybe that's God, right there at the moment, or the marquee at a church around the corner from my house that says God is love. Well, maybe it's the other way around too. I don't know, but I do believe there's something divine in us, between us, and in this life. And I think my job, my personal belief, is that little piece of divinity in me. My job is to know it, to honor it, to grow it best I can every day, every year. I'm not real good at it, but I'm trying.
So will you leave this world thinking that there is something beyond this world?
No.
No.
I will leave this world thinking, damn, I wish I didn't have to leave. I believe that I will live on to the extent that other people carry me with them.
Afterlife is memory.
Yeah. So, you know, probably my grandson, Sam. But, you know, my body, you know, I'll continue after I'm dead, my body will continue what I'm doing now and trying to nurture the world best I can. So I'll nurture, you know, that small area of the environment. I just had a conversation with Sam when I was going through all these.
And I should mention, Sam is your autistic grandson to whom you dedicated your previous book. It was called Letters to Sam. And the book was written in the form of letters to him.
Right. And Sam's doing really well, by the way, really well. And we have a wonderful relationship, and he torments me about being bald. And I try
very
to
nice.
I try to take it like a man, but I one day I failed, and I explained to him in six-year-old terms the genetics of baldness. And I told him he was going to have my hairline when he grew up, which he refused to acknowledge. So anyway, when I went through these acute health crises this summer, Sam pulled me aside And he said, Pop, he said, how old am I going to be when you die? It opened up a wonderful discussion about death. And I asked him what it meant to him and what he was worried about. So he said he was scared that he would miss me, that he wouldn't see me again. And I asked him what he thought would happen to me after I died. And he described his version of heaven, the kind we tell kids. And I said, Sam, if I am in heaven, do you think I'll still be loving you up there? And he said, well, sure. And I said, will you still be loving me? And he said, well, yeah. And I said, Sam, do you think you'll be able to feel my love for you? And he said, thought for a long time about that. He said, I think I will, Pop. So I said, so we have that going on. So death isn't going to stop that part. It's not going to stop the love part. It'll stop the visiting part, the seeing part, but it won't stop the love part. And Sam seemed to feel a bit better, and I said to him, Sam, there's one more thing. I said, if you're right, if there is a heaven up there, and if I'm up there, I said, when you get older and you start to lose your hair, I'm going to laugh my ass off at you.
My guest is psychologist and family therapist Dan Gottlieb. A car accident nearly 29 years ago left him paralyzed from the chest down.
You've got a new book called Learning from the Heart, and your previous book, Letters to Sam, which was Letters to Your Autistic Grandson, that did really well. Printed in 14 languages, sold a lot. And you were telling me before the interview started, I didn't know this, that you donated all the royalties to charity. And I'm thinking, like, that's a that's a really generous thing to do. I mean, why did you decide to do that?
Well, I've got to be candid. Part of my thinking comes from my ethnic background. And that says to me, if I was going to keep the money, I wouldn't make any money. And if I'm going to give it away, it's going to make a lot of money.
Oh, so you committed before you knew it would make money. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I did, actually. I did.
Okay.
I think I made it clear. I like my life. I really like it the way it is. I'm very happy with my life. And in terms of money, you know, I can pay my mortgage and I can take myself out to dinner almost whenever I want. I can take a couple vacations a year. So, you know, so what? So what do I need more money for? And there's so many people in this world in so much pain, and so many children are suffering. And, you know, what am I going to do? Buy a couple more suits? You know, it's the best feeling I've ever had, Tari. It's just a wonderful feeling.
Since you've talked about how you fear your body is getting tired and that you've turned a corner, do you mind if I ask you a couple of questions about facing a body that you feel is getting tired? Do you get scared of what that means?
No. I might sometimes in the middle of the night, but by and large, no. I feel sad. But when I am living with death, I'm living with life. I'm more alive. When I feel death nearby, I feel life nearby. They go together. And I think to a certain extent, that's true for all of us. I refuse to believe I'm different from anybody else in that regard.
But do you still worry about what the circumstances will be? Because so many people just obsess on that. You know, will I be in pain? Will I be alone? Will I be at home? Will I be in the hospital?
I know all those answers, most of them.
You do?
I don't know about the pain, but I'll be at home. I'll be with a nurse because that's how I live. So all the stuff that most people worry about, I've been there. I've done that. Two stories.
Yeah.
One is, I tell a story about a patient I saw years ago who was obese and had two artificial knees, and he was sitting in a chair in a session. The chair was probably too low, and he labored to get out. And you could see he was working really hard to get out of the chair. And he gets up, and he takes a breath, and he looks down. He says, you know, he said, I probably shouldn't say this, but I look down at you, and I think, thank God I can get up. And I said, well, I shouldn't say this either, but I look at you and I think, thank God I'm not going to have to go through all that when I get older. And I felt the same thing with in Tuesdays with Maury. There was one point early in his disease where he says to Mitch, oh, my God, somebody's going to have to wipe me one day. And I'm reading this and I'm thinking, you get used to it. And you get used to stuff. So all of the things that people are afraid of, becoming dependent, winding up in a wheelchair, having an attendant with them full time, I've been there. It's not that bad. You get used to stuff. So, you know, I didn't think much about pain. I really hope that doesn't happen. But I'm not afraid. I'm mostly sad because, for obvious reasons, I love my life so much. I love almost everything about it.
Dan, it's really been great to talk with you.
And you, Terry. I appreciate our time together.
Dr. Dan Gottlieb's new book is called Learning from the Heart. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.
Fareed Zakaria is an optimist. He believes in the ability of the United States to adapt. But in his new book, The Post-American World, Zakaria raises a tantalizing argument that the war in Iraq could mark the decline of American power. He offers the argument, and then he rebuts it. Zakaria is a columnist and the editor of Newsweek International, and the possible precedent that he cites for the U.S. coming undone in Iraq is what happened to Britain just over a century ago in South Africa during the Boer War. Fareed Zakaria, welcome. And I'd like you to start with what the possible relevance of the Boer War is to the present day.
Well, it's actually a very similar moment. Britain is as close as you could get, Imperial Britain, to America today. It was the only truly global power. It was larger than in terms of its navy than every other country. In fact, it was larger than the next two navies put together. It ran this vast empire. A quarter of the land surface of the earth and a quarter of the people were ruled by the British Empire. I pointed out that at Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, a fourth of humanity got the day off because she was being, you know, celebrated. They go into the Boer War just after a spectacular military victory against a native force in the Battle of Omdurman. And for me, that there are many similarities with Afghanistan. A battle that many people thought the British would do badly at, Omdurman, they did fantastically.
So they're confident in themselves.
They're confident, and there is an element of hubris. One British parliamentarian says, this is the British Empire against a group of Dutch farmers, meaning the Boers. Mm-hmm. And even though by the end, several years later, the British Army wins, it breaks the back of the British Empire. They have huge casualties. It exposes massive incompetence and corruption. And it begins a process in which the British Empire is unable to maintain this vast set of commitments it has all over the world and at the same time remain a competitive economy. You know, there's a sense in which it is the people in London are too worried about the constitutional arrangements of Dutch farmers in the southern Transvaal and not worried enough about the core, which is British strength, industrial, technological, and the rise of Germany and the United States as economic competitors to Britain.
So
in that way, there is a parallel.
So for those who are completely now captured by your parable of what could befall the United States, in the end you say no. You think that the United States has virtues going for it that can avoid the sort of decline that Britain experienced in the 20th century.
You put it exactly right. It can avoid that decline. We are at a similar moment. Britain, at the end of the day, had a problem which it couldn't solve, which was that it was declining economically and technologically, and Germany and the United States were overtaking it. The British economy had lost steam by the early 1900s. The American economy today remains extraordinarily strong, very powerful, vibrant, creative, dynamic. But it is facing enormous new competition. If the rise of Germany and the United States were the core reality of the early 20th century, the core reality of the earliest 21st century is what I call the rise of the rest. Everyone is rising. It's not just Asia. It's everywhere. And what America has to figure out is how do we reorient our strategy, economic, political, foreign policy, so that we thrive in this world. We, you know, lead, master, help shape this world, rather than being buffeted by the forces of the rise of the rest, the way Britain was. We have a much stronger hand, but we do have to adapt.
And you would suggest that the role that the United States can find in the world is not as the great imperial or the great superpower, as we would say now, but rather as a kind of global chairman of the board.
That's exactly right. The age of American unipolarity is over. You just have to look around the world, Robert. The largest company in the world is now in Beijing. The richest man in the world is in Mexico. The tallest building in the world is in Dubai. You know, the largest casino in the world is in Macau, in China. All those things, by the way, just 5, 10, 15 years ago were all topped by Americans. So the world has changed. And in that context, we have to recognize that leadership will mean something very different. And as I say, you know, a chairman of a board can be very powerful as long as he recognizes that he is the chairman of the board, not the dictator.
When you speak of being the chairman of the board, though, in the world, well, you have one example, which is of how Imperial Germany under Bismarck behaved itself in international company. In present terms, how might the U.S. behave in a way that would exemplify this chairman's role that you describe?
You know, the world that we're living in now is enormously productive. It has the rise of the rest taking place. It means lots of countries are growing, but it's producing all kinds of problems, from environmental problems, problems relating to oil prices, problems relating to the coordination of anything from health to human rights. And, of course, the rise of national pride complicates all this. What the United States could do is to really play a central role in trying to bring to the global agenda the issues that need to be dealt with, figuring out what forums they should be dealt with in, bringing together the right countries to deal with these problems. That would be something where it would be a win-win. The world would be grateful to us. We would be advancing our interests. We would be shaping the world in a way that we believe it should be shaped, rather than narrowly protecting our own interests and saying, well, the International Criminal Court may be a great idea, but we're not going to be a part of it. You know, to really recognize that in order to lead the world, we truly will have to be a part of it. We can't stand outside. You know, the United States is the only country in the world, with the exception of Liberia and Myanmar, that is not on the metric system. And we've always had this view that there might be rules, universal rules even. They're wonderful. They just don't need to apply to us because we're special. And what I'm trying to say in the book, and I call it the post-American world for that reason, is that that special dispensation is done with.
The end of American exceptionalism.
The end of American exceptionalism, because the gap between us and the world is no longer that large. And people look at the United States and say, you know, if we can figure out the metric system, you should be able to as well.
Fareed Zakaria, thank you very much for talking with us today.
A pleasure, Robert.
Fareed Zakaria's new book is called The Post-American World, and you can hear more of our conversation at npr.org.